Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Renee. Welcome to Renee's Heart to Heart. Thanks for joining me tonight. You know, I found some very dismal things today that I'm going to share with everybody, only because I think that they need talking about. The first thing is so unbelievable, but when I read this, I think the rest of tonight's show will show you how much we all need to start paying attention to what's going on and participating and doing something about what we see going on around us. This letter was given to a woman in a neighborhood in Canada. And it's all over the internet. It's addressed to the lady living at this address. I also live in this neighborhood and have a problem. You have a kid that is mentally handicapped, and you consciously decided that it would be a good idea to live in a close proximity neighborhood like this. You selfishly put your kid outside every day and let him be nothing but a nuisance and a problem to everyone else with that noise-polluting wailing he constantly makes. That noise he makes when he is outside is dreadful. It scares the hell out of my normal children. When you feel your idiot kid needs fresh air, take him to our park, you dope. We have a nature trail. Let him run around those places and make noise. Crying babies, music, and even barking dogs are normal sounds in a residential neighborhood. He is not. He is a hindrance to everyone and will always be that way. Who the hell is going to care for him? No employer will hire him. No normal girl is going to marry him, love him, and you are not going to live forever. Personally, they should take whatever non-retarded body parts he possesses and donate it to science. What the hell else good is he to anyone? You had a retarded kid. Deal with it properly. What right do you have to do this to hardworking people? I hate people like you who believe just because you have a special needs kid, you are entitled to special treatment. God, do everyone in our community a huge favor and move. Vamoose. Scram. Move away and get out of this type of neighborhood setting. Go live in a trailer in the woods or something with your wild animal kid. Nobody wants you living here and they don't have the guts to tell you. Do the right thing and move or euthanize him. Either way, we are all better off. Sincerely, one pissed off mother. Now, for me, that whole letter, if it's for real, you know, part of me, that Pollyanna part of me wants to believe that nobody would really write a letter like that. But then again, the more I peruse through the internet and the more things that I read about our behavior, anything is possible. It's a terrible thing when you know that the world you live in, the world you love, the world you are a big part of, is turning into people like this. I just don't get it. I really don't get it. And you know what really bothers me more than anything is some of the other things I read about. Something I'm going to read to all of you tonight is about the parents of other children. This is somebody who loves a child that's difficult to take care of is a special person. And, you know, I've always said when I've been teaching people about the service industry, working in hotels and restaurants and, of course, the Institute, the people that are the most difficult to take care of need us the most. But on the same token, how can anybody, first of all, do that to another human being, say those things? The child wouldn't care, you understand. If the child is in a place where they're just playing and having a good time, this person didn't hurt that child. This person hurt this mom, this caregiver. Having a child with special needs doesn't mean you don't love them just as much as you possibly can. So that broke my heart, but I felt the need to share it because, like I said, it's all over the internet, and it's all about other people's poor, boorish, unthinking, self-centered behavior, which is one of the things that we talk about on this show all the time. I also wanted to mention that, because we've kept a bit of an eye on Caitlin Hunt, I mentioned her a couple weeks ago again, she was given an order by the judge in Northern Florida, in Sebastian. And the order said that she could be home as long as she stayed away from the 14-year-old girl, her girlfriend. And the attorney for the 14-year-old, actually for the 14-year-old's parents, found some messages to the tune of, I don't know, thousands of messages. And she disobeyed the judge's order to stay away from this 14-year-old girl. Obviously, she thinks she's in love. Obviously, she's making some very poor choices. But now he's revoked any kind of bail or bond. So she has to sit in jail until she has a hearing. And at this point in time, there's no hearing date set. But I must say, and then in the meantime, her mom got involved and called the 14-year-old and said, erase all the messages so nobody can see them. So who knows why we do the things we do. And I would like to say, you know, I wouldn't do that, but I don't know. If I was in that position and I was worried about my daughter and my daughter made me believe that she was hurt and in love and pining, and I don't know. It's a hard thing to guess whether or not we would do the same thing as somebody else, because you know what they say about hindsight. So whenever you're looking at somebody else's mistakes, it's easy to judge and say what you would have done, could have done, should have done, etc. But this puts this young woman in a jail cell until another hearing. And even then, I don't know, when you do something like this, there's something about disobeying an order from a court that doesn't sit well with anybody. Because, again, we have to have rules. We have to have guidelines. We have to know what we're supposed to do. It doesn't necessarily make us make the right choices, but we should know what we're supposed to do. And she was told what she was supposed to do. And if she really wants to spend her life, the rest of her life, with this young woman when she becomes of age, then she should have been thinking about that, not thinking about what we all think about, which is instant gratification. And it's a shame. Because of this, in a world that's finally becoming very accepting of same-sex marriages, of all the things that we're finally realizing are a part of our nature, she's ruined it for herself. It will always be a challenge to make this happen now, just because she couldn't refrain long enough to get herself out of the hot seat. So I have lots of empathy for her. I'm a little annoyed with her. If she was my kid, if she was my friend, if she was my friend's kid, I'd be saying, what in the hell were you thinking? Why didn't you behave yourself just for these few months? If things are supposed to be, they will be when they're supposed to be. So during my perusal of the internet today, I found all these stories. I found a few silly stories about movie stars and what have you. But on the news this morning, early this morning, I was awoken to a comment from one of the Today Show people about DCF in Florida. And the fact that because Department of Children and Families is overworked, overburdened, all of the excuses that we have heard for many, 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 many years, and we've lost many children just in this year. And apparently there's a new director of DCF, and she hasn't done much better. So a couple stories I pulled up, and one I just want to give you a little bit of insight over the kind of stuff that we're talking about. And I'm not going to read this whole story because it's quite a long one, but a little girl by the name of Jewel sat on her grandma's lap. Grandma watched her cry often, and they spent the days together, and the little girl would talk about someday she was going to be a princess. And less than 15 hours later, this little girl was dead. Her liver was torn and mangled, her ribs were crushed, and she was bruised and bleeding internally. And her paternal grandmother, who often took care of her, was mortified. Now, this, as I said, is a fairly long story. But it needs to be told. A month ago, the head of the state agency designed to protect Florida's children resigned amid a widening scandal over the deaths of four small children within 6 weeks, all with a history of involvement with child abuse investigators. The reality of mounting child deaths in Florida is far grimmer. A Miami Herald investigation, which included a review of hundreds of pages of agency emails, incident reports, and other documents obtained through Florida's public records law, shows the number of children who died is nearly four times what had been acknowledged. Jewel is among 20 children with child protection histories who have died since April 11th. A span that saw the resignation of Department of Children and Families Secretary David Wilkins. We are deeply saddened anytime a child dies in Florida, but especially when DCF has had prior involvement with their families, said Esther Jacobo, the DCF's interim secretary. That's why I've ordered a review of all the child fatalities caused by abuse or neglect and invited a nationally renowned Child Welfare Foundation to scrutinize the findings. You know, this is kind of like shutting the door after the cow got out, or however that old saying goes. I don't know what this is going to prove. I think the deaths are proof enough that we screwed up. But even before the new tally, legislatures were working to try to stanch the trend. Never even heard that terminology. I guess it means stop the insanity. The chairwoman of the state Senate's Children, Family, and Elders Affairs Committee, Hollywood Democrat Eleanor Sobel, will host a town hall meeting Tuesday with members of the delegations of Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach counties. Jacoba will be there to discuss steps that the department is taking to prevent any more tragedies. In an August 1st letter to Governor Rick Scott, four members of the United States House of Representatives from Florida urged the governor to convene an independent panel to recommend reforms that go beyond fleeting promises and overhauls. Amen. Weeks before Jewel died, the three-year-old had told her birth father that her mother's boyfriend had beaten her face, leaving a large laceration on her lip requiring stitches, according to a DCF report. And although both Jewel's mother and her boyfriend already had a substantial history of arrests and charges, DCF didn't act for weeks. Sufficient time for Jewel to die brutally and alone, police allege, at the hands of the couple one Friday in April, the morning after she had gotten her hair done and played princess with her grandma. As with Jewel, the deadly toll from newborns to teenagers was caused mostly by one or the other of the youngster's own parents, all of whom had come to DCF's attention at least once before the tragedies occurred. They unfolded across the state, the cases bound only by the role the state did or did not play in the period leading up to the child's death. June was the deadliest month, claiming seven children, including victims who drowned, were strangled, or beaten. The most recent death was just 4 days ago. Among the child deaths that have received little scrutiny, a one-year-old girl in the panhandle's Franklin County. The girl's mother was already a subject of child abuse hotline reports that her four children, ranging from 8 years to 1 year, were at risk because she was smoking crack in front of them. Mom sells items and her food stamps in order to purchase street drugs in addition to abusing her prescription drugs, the hotline caller said. On May 7th, an incident report says the children's mother and a group of her friends watched in horror as a friend ran over the infant with a truck, eliciting a piercing scream from the baby. This sounds like make-believe. This sounds like a Stephen King novel, and this is really going on. The mother was on the ground next to a gray truck crying and saying, my baby, over and over again. A police officer wrote in a report, I noticed the child had an injury to the forehead. In an email, DCF's panhandle chief, Vicki Abrams, called the baby's death a tragic accident, adding, no indication of abuse or neglect. Christian Bird, two-year-old Christian, drowned in a swimming pool behind the home of the Lehigh Acres daycare on June 24th. The daycare owner, 42-year-old Melissa Smith, told DCF she left three children, all younger than three, in the above-ground swimming pool while she went to the bathroom. When she returned outside, she observed Christian floating in the water. A two-and-a-half-year-old Citrus County boy, the toddler's family already under the supervision of a privately run child welfare agency, when he wandered out of his home and drowned June 23rd. Now, these things, although horrendous, this is because, as we have said so many times, having a child does not make you a parent. Having a baby doesn't make you a mom, and fathering a child doesn't make you a dad. The family came under DCF supervision in January when the agency's hotline received a report that an infant sibling was suffering from failure to thrive. Emails from DCF Central Florida Director William Diutu, don't know how to say his name, said the Kids Central Child Welfare Group had given the family locks and child alarms for their doors, but the safety devices were not in use when the toddler died. The family said they never got the locks and alarms. After the little boy drowned, DCF's response was to develop a plan in which the parents pledged to better supervise the surviving infant and install locks that could be saved, that could have saved the baby's older brother. An email also noted with apparent satisfaction, "We don't anticipate any media involvement." 16-year-old Brevard County girl placed in foster care and then was reunited with her father under the supervision of a privately run Devereaux Child Welfare Agency. She died possibly of pneumonia and a heart attack, 16, around May 11th. Department emails say the girl's family members knew that she had gone to live with a 24-year-old boyfriend and did not have serious concerns about the relationship, even when the couple left the state. And as early as May 2nd, the teen's caseworker knew she had gone missing. The adult boyfriend emails say took the teen to Indiana, where the girl became critically ill. She was hospitalized on May 10th, released from the hospital, and died a day or two later. This goes on, and, you know, I'm not going to read the rest of this because it just gets, it's very repetitious. It's all about the people who are supposed to be watching out for these children. What's their reason? Is it because they're overworked? They have too many kids to take care of? Is it because, like I see in so many other scenarios, there's too much paperwork? I mean, you'd think, wouldn't you, with the help of computers, the paperwork should be to a minimum. But as wonderful as the computers and all this technology is, nobody trusts it enough. They don't trust that they're going to always have it. So they make hard copies. If you go to a doctor today, you fill out the same piece of paper. The kids that started school, two of them have been at the same schools already for a while now, a couple of years, and we still had to fill out all the same paperwork. Repetitious, repetitious, repetitious. So this is wasting time when there's really problems that are out there and really, really horrible, horrific things happening. Shelley has joined us. She was working late tonight. I'm going to bring her in. Hi, honey.
Hey, Reed. Shell? I'm here. I couldn't get my phone on mute.
Oh. I've been talking about awful things tonight. I know you've heard a little bit of it, but you didn't hear much of it.
Yeah.
But my second paper was published about 3 weeks ago, and it's a story done by the Miami Herald. And it says, the death toll of South Florida children at the hands of abusive, drug-addicted, and negligent adults is stunning. But just as outrageous is that some point along the road to the fatal outcomes, the deaths might have been prevented had the state agency in charge of protecting Florida's children, the Department of Children and Families, had not so miserably failed them. Jaden Villegas, 2 years old, died Sunday from brain injuries, and his father, a man with a record of aggression, was charged with his murder. He told police he threw the toddler across the bed and against the wall because he would not stop vomiting. Why was this child in this monster's care? Jaden was taken away from his mother, a substance abuser, who is pregnant again and has an older child as well. She lost custody of Jaden after she blamed the child's earlier injury, a broken thigh bone, on his hyperactive older sibling. DCF, suspicious of the explanation, gave Jaden's custody to the even less adept father. And so Jaden became the fifth child to die since May, whose parents are under scrutiny by DCF. Brian Osceola, 11 months old, was left to die in a hot car by his alcohol and drug-addicted mother. She had been investigated and cleared by a child abuse investigator of passing out drunk behind the wheel of a car with the baby in her lap. Ezra Raphael, age 2, was beaten to death with a belt after his mother left him alone with her boyfriend. DCF closed its investigation despite finding the child was at a high risk with his mother. Antoine Hope, age 4, died after being left alone against a judge's order with his mentally ill mother. And Fernando Barahona, only 1 year old, stopped breathing in his crib 2 weeks after the Department of Children and Families returned him to his mother. In all those horrific cases, there's one constant. DCF failed to act on not just warning signs, but brilliant red lights flashing at everyone that these children were being harmed. Attentive and caring child welfare workers could have easily been clued in to these children's hellish worlds, and in some cases they were. But these alleged professionals, the investigators and their supervisors, were not listening, not heeding the signs, not acting as if these were life or death scenarios. In the aftermath of the latest deaths, DCF's chief resigned. That may be an appropriate political move, but it doesn't solve the chronic issues that have led to a legacy of failures. It's clear there's much that ails this agency, but one of the basic problems is the radical operating philosophy that only under the most extreme circumstances should children be removed from the birth parents. And if they are, the philosophy is to return them as soon as you can. That has proven too deadly for Florida's at-risk children. Keeping children safe should trump everything else. It's time for the highest authorities in the state to step in, investigate, and substantially change the modus operandi of the agency charged with protecting the most vulnerable amongst us. Listen to the children. Their deaths speak volumes. Now, I have very mixed emotions about this, because I have witnessed different stories in my life where misunderstandings have torn apart families. And I have also witnessed everything that I just read. I think this is, again, as it is very often, a problem in about the training of the people that are given the responsibility to make these decisions. They cannot not be fully trained. They cannot. They have to be, first of all, real people. They have to be able to watch body language. They have to be able to assess a room, the hominess, the comfort, all the things that make a home should be there. If they're not, there's one flag. Without even seeing any interactions, that should be one flag. I'm not talking about a messy house either. I'm not talking about that at all. It's hard to keep a clean house when you have a house full of kids. I'm talking about the warmth in a room. I'm talking about peanut butter and jelly in the cupboard. I'm talking about milk in the refrigerator. These are the little things. I'm not talking about a stash of chocolate chip cookies and ice cream and root beer. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the very simple things. It's not difficult to make a child happy. It never is difficult to make a child happy if they feel safe and secure. If you're in a house where a child doesn't feel safe and secure and you've been properly trained, you should know it.
Yeah, you should be able to tell by looking at the child, looking at their body language. Do they look at you? Do they keep their eyes down? You know, you can tell when a child is in fear or not in a good place somehow.
Well, in most cases, shockingly, kids find it very difficult to narc on their parents. But if it's been something that they've been going through for a long time, there's some things that they just can't hide.
Right.
You know, they can lie with their voice, but they can't lie with their energy. Something should tell you.
Right, but there's also a difference between, like you said, they should be able to look at the surroundings and pick up cues on that. And there's a big difference between a messy house and a filthy house. You know,
yeah.
I mean, you can have a messy house and have clothes all over the place and maybe not picked up, and maybe there's a sink full of dishes. But if there's dishes from one end of the counter to the other, if there's rotting food, if you've got bugs crawling all over the place in the middle of the day, hey, you've got an issue here. You've got somebody that's just not even making an attempt. So, messy, one thing, very, very messy, fine. I mean, I've been there, done that, you know. I mean, I don't have children, but I've had close family members that had children, and I saw what their house got like, but it didn't stay like that. And there was no filth involved. There's, like I said, it's a big difference between messy, even a full sink of dishes that is spilling over, you know. But when if it's something that lasts for a day or two and it's just kind of gotten away from you, you can tell if those dishes have been piling up for a couple of days or if they've been piling up for a couple of weeks. You can just tell. And there's a huge difference there in getting just a little tired or behind your chores and being completely neglectful.
That's right. It's all about just paying attention. It's all about, and again, being trained properly, and not being so overburdened with knowing that you're not supposed to work more than 8 hours because your organization or your department is on a wage concern or something. I mean, you know, there's always stuff. There's always reasons, and people can hand them out faster than they can, M&Ms, for God's sakes. It's like there's always an excuse for everything. But the point is this is getting very scary, and we're talking so much about how kids hurt each other. We spend a lot of time on this show talking about bullies, talking about the abuse that other kids do to other kids. One of the stories I read today was three boys in, I think it was Oklahoma, were bored, and they had their dad's shotgun, and this 17-year-old boy who was there from, I think, Australia or someplace like that, on a baseball scholarship to go to high school there and to go on to college and to play for a major league team. They decided, they told the police, they decided since they were so bored, they were going to see what it was like to kill somebody. So they shot this boy and killed him.
Oh, my God.
And when the police arrived and questioned them and everything, they said, we were bored. We just wondered what it would be like. And we talk about those kind of things all the time. I mean, not necessarily that particular story. That was pretty strange and off the wall, but not the first time we've read an article or something or a story about somebody who's committed a horrible crime just because they didn't have anything better to do and they thought it would be amusing to do it. But in the same token, these are kids that obviously maybe were the survivors of some of these families that we're talking about. You know, maybe they were the ones that got to be 17 instead of their life ending when they were 3. And they grew up in surroundings like that. I don't know. I'm just talking off the top of my head. But it's possible that that's where those kind of stories are being generated from, because in the beginning, like we've talked about so many times, when you're supposed to be teaching, training, allowing to grow a new life and leading them, directing them in the right places, and you're not, you know, it doesn't even always work if you dedicate yourself to that. I've seen that too. But the point is if you, you know, if you do the things that you should be doing, or at least try, but to live in a home where a child is constantly, chronically, continually abused, and a teacher, we've talked about this in the very beginning of the show, we talked about some of the abusiveness that we see go past everybody because nobody wants to get involved. And then something silly will happen. A little girl comes in crying one day and decides she doesn't want to tell the real truth, and she says something, you know, Daddy spanked me, or Daddy did this, or and all of a sudden Daddy's in a world of shit and can't get out of it, and they ruined their lives.
Yeah.
It's there's not an easy fix, but what there is an opportunity here to pay attention. And the more eyes you have on a situation, the better the outcome is going to be. If I were doing that and I couldn't go myself, I would send three of my very best people to a house where somebody told me, something's fishy here, you know, something's going on, and this happened and that happened. I wouldn't leave it up to that one person. Would you, Shelley? Wouldn't you want, if you couldn't be there yourself, if you couldn't go look yourself, of course, that's my downfall. I always think I'm going to know and I have to go and find out what's going on, which isn't always the truth, but that's my personality. But say you can't. So you send three of your other best people that know the ropes, that have been in the field a long time, and everybody comes back with a report. The kids might be safer that way.
Mm-hmm.
The kids might have an opportunity. And I'm not always so sure that even leaving a bad situation with a mom and dad to another mom and dad that don't really love them but want that $600 a month or whatever it is, that's the answer either.
I know, and unfortunately, that's one of the reasons why some of these children are so damaged, is because here they're taken out of one abusive situation and just put in another one. So it's like, so where's the solution? Where was the fix? You know?
Yeah.
And
it's
a travesty that you have people that look at children as dollar signs anyway. And it's a very sad commentary on a segment of our society. Thank God it's a very small segment. But it's a very small segment that impacts thousands upon thousands of children, to tens of thousands of children, in any given moment, at any given day. And you know that there's all these children out there that are suffering, and that their potential and their light is just being put out to the point where they're going to suffer so much that they're not going to be able to rally and bring it back up without some extreme intervention from very patient and loving people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't, you know, for me, it is hard. You sometimes have to even second guess yourself when you see that you think something's not quite right. But if you feel like you need to second guess yourself, that should be the first flag. If you feel like there's just something that isn't sitting right with you, you can't ignore it. And that's anything. That's anything we do. DCF, for as long as I can remember, has been under great scrutiny, because they're in a very unrewarding job. I mean, if you have to go into the home of somebody that you know has got problems, maybe there's drugs or alcohol or both, or no money, or illness of one parent or something, that in itself, that job, without any of these other these other horrible things playing their way out, that all on its own is a very unrewarding, very tough job to do. Walk into somebody's house and critique what's going on in their home and check everything out and make sure everything's the way it's supposed to be.
But if that's the job that these people have chosen, then, and they realize, obviously, they have to realize that they have a child's life basically in their control, then you either do the job. I mean, I can't understand why somebody would take that job and then not put more into it, not be more aware, not, you know, if you have too many case files on your desk, then you have to say something. And unfortunately, I think part of the problem is, because I've heard some of these stories, and apparently these people are terribly overworked, overburdened, and then, you know, a tragedy like this happens, and it's like they don't know where to get the recourse. And
mm-hmm.
that's not an excuse, you know. They try to do the best they can. I'm talking about the ones that have actually spoken. So I don't know
right.
if there are some agents that just are not competent. I don't know if it's a lack of training, because I don't know what type of training they have to go through. Do you know what type of training a DSF agent has to go through? Do they have to have any certifications? Do they have to?
They do. They do. But you can do it almost any. I mean, When I left Hippocrates and started looking for a job, I saw advertisements all the time, you know, be a welfare worker, or be a, what's the other name for them, not welfare worker, but there's other names that they call them, and there's organizations that will certify you and things like that. But again, that's, you know, that would be teaching you the rules. It wouldn't be able to teach you about the common sense part of things. And if you don't possess that.
A lot of people are taking this, getting basically the book knowledge, but they're lacking the instinct or the
right.
or the
exactly.
observant skills.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're missing the clues. I don't know. It's such a tragic situation. And, you know, I agree with you. The bottom line is training, is getting people out there, number one, teaching them how to be more savvy, how to be more observant, how to pick up on personality cues. You know, when people that work for the FBI, they're trained on human behavior. So they're just about trained to be a lie detector just by how someone moves muscles in their face. And there's something like 100 different facial tics that we have that we're not even aware of that a trained FBI agent would be able to know right off the bat if you're telling the truth, if you're telling a lie, if you're just shooting from the hip and making something up, or if you're retrieving something from your memory by how you move your eyes and different facial expressions you make. You know, now it sounds probably like an impossible task. But I think when you're talking about somebody that has to go in and assess the safety of a child, they should be learning some basic personality cues so that they can tell if they're even...
I just lost you, honey. No.
Okay.
Say again.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah,
can
I got
you,
you now. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so they should get, like, basic behavioral training so that they can even, so that it would guide them into assessing the situation with more accuracy. You know, because sometimes you do have people that just had one bad day and it's not something that's going to recur. And other times you have people that have mental disorders and they shouldn't have a child in their house. You know, and I think that's what you were getting at before, where it's like some of these cases is just somebody who lost it on one day. You know, they had a bad moment, but it was an accident or something like that. And then you have other people that are downright negligent or abusive, you know. And how are you going to tell the difference between the two when the end result for the child is the same? You have to be able to look at cues. You have to be able to look at how the child interacts with that parent. Is there any fear there? Is there any aversion? You know, to be able to really discern whether or not we're talking a one-time accident or if we're talking about something that's repetitive. And,
exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Somebody
with a little bit deeper instinct than just being trained the do's and don'ts of a job like that. Exactly.
But that's what I'm talking about. And I keep going back to, like, FBI agents, okay, because they have to go through such rigorous training. They build the instincts as part of the – as they hone their skill, they become extremely instinctual, all right? Now, you're talking about people that are in charge of – literally in charge of saving a child's life. Why isn't there stricter guidelines for the training they have to go through? I find that mind-boggling.
Well, I think it's because it's not a high –
jobs there are, this is one of the most critical as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely it is. But it's not – it doesn't pay so wonderfully. It's not a 9-to-5 job. If you don't really believe in it, if it's not really something you're doing for reasons other than just a job, then you probably don't do it to the best of your ability, because it could get very draining, very difficult. I mean, it's like a nurse. You have great nurses, and you have nurses that, oh, my God, what were you thinking, you know?
Right.
So some of them are like, you look at them and you think, oh, my God, I just wish I could hug her. She's just, she really, really cares. And you watch the way they touch people that are no longer beautiful or smell good and everything, and you see the love and the way they're reacting to them. These people are the true angels of mercy. They're the ones that when you think of a nurse, that's what your mind conjures up. But we both know they're not all like that. And it's the same thing with DCF. You've got people in there that took it as a job because they thought they had a little flair for being able to talk to people, and in some cases they probably do. But they have to have more than that, because this is a whole different thing, this scenario with walking into somebody else's home and passing judgment on them and possibly tearing apart a family that, like you just said, is just having a bad week or a bad day, as compared to walking into a home where turmoil and anger and all the terrible things that I just read are an everyday occurrence. You have to be able to know the difference.
Right.
And that's what seems to be so difficult.
In any of the articles that you read, has anybody written about the DCF having to, or the DCF being scrutinized in such a way that they're looking to maybe change the procedures of how they monitor families or how they monitor a child's welfare? Is there any kind of an overhaul of DCS that's being contemplated?
Yes, and they are doing that, and they are looking at everything again, but it all ends up it all ends up being along the same idea. Let me find that one, the end of the one thing. I think this is the one you heard too, but it's it's clear there's much that ails this agency, but one of the basic problems is the radical operating philosophy that only under the most extreme circumstances should children be removed from the birth parents. And if they are, the philosophy is to return them as soon as you can. So again, that's a great thing to say. That's a great thing to feel. And I feel the same way. I think I shared a story of my own years ago when I took care of three kids from the same family, and they were all special children for different reasons, but mostly it was because of the abuse at the hands of their birth mother, who was no longer part of the picture. When I got them, they were like, two were five and one was seven. And the five-year-olds were twins, a boy and a girl, and they struggled with lots of things. The little boy had a major speech impediment, lots of issues. He and I struggled a lot. He taught me probably as much as anybody has ever taught me in my whole life. And his twin sister, her issues were not as great as his, but she had other stuff. She was five. He couldn't go to school, but she got to go to school. And the oldest sister had an extreme speech impediment. And they were back living with their real father, who was somebody that lived in the same neighborhood where our house was as my kids were growing up. And I became licensed through the New York State daycare organization to take care of kids and be paid by social service because these kids were receiving social service help. So they would come and check on me, and I did this even before I had these kids so that I could have kids that were in the middle of a horrible, violent divorce proceedings between their parents, and a couple different times the father had come and held a gun to all their heads. And so I had to go to court for that and became licensed for the first time with the New York State Daycare Association so that I could take care of those kids, and that way the mother could have custody of them. So anyway, I had some previous experience with all of this. And when they would come to visit my house and see the kids and everything, they would say to me, "Do you think we should take the three kids away from their father?" And I said, "You know, he's far from being the perfect dad, far from it." And every Monday I would have to kind of like start all over again with certain things. But there's one thing I knew for sure. I knew it then and I know it now. He loved them to death. He loved them. They were not beautiful. They were not precociously cute and funny and sweet like some little kids, you know. If somebody else had taken them in, it would have been for the money. Because somebody else, no matter how special they were, would not have loved them because they were difficult. And I told the organization that, and DCF, I mean, they didn't call it that up north, they called it something else, but it was the same thing. And they said to me, "But, you know, we know that he drinks on weekends, we know that he does that." And I said, "Yes, you're right about all those things." I said, "But he loves them. He really loves them. He struggled to get them back. He goes to work every day. If I say one of the girls need new underwear or new this or new that, they get it, you know, and he struggled with money, but he still made sure that they had everything they needed." And they really, really wanted to take them away from him because he was not the picture of a perfect dad. And I said, "You're crazy if you do, because they will, right now they all have each other. The chances of you putting them in a home where which somebody would take all three is very low." They agreed with me. I said, "And he loves them. And they're with me all week. You know, until they get older, I'll still probably be their daycare mother." And I was for a long time. As a matter of fact, one of them got in touch with me. The boy died in a car accident a few years ago. But the girls are still near their father. They're both married and everything, but they're near their father still after all these years. So it was the right decision. If they'd have pulled them apart, it would have been a horrible travesty to those kids. Things weren't perfect, but they were as close as they were going to be for them.
Right, right. Wow, that's amazing.
But it's, you know...
And they have a relationship. So you're saying in uniform, but they still have a relationship with him too. I'm guessing.
Yeah, yeah. They still see him. All, he lives very close to both of the girls. And
wow.
I said, that's wonderful. You know, I'm so glad. Did your dad remarry? Yeah. You know, but they're not married anymore. And I said, okay, you know, he was like an old redneck. It was all he knew. And, but again, you know, if something was wrong with one of them, I could watch him. And he really, really loved them. And as
aww.
Far as I was concerned, that was more important than a lot of the other stuff, you know. So, for me, that should be a part of it as well. You know, I mean, I've been in a situation with parents that are doing everything by the book, and I see no love, no love.
Exactly.
And that makes
right.
me sadder than anything.
Yeah,
you
well,
know?
I mean, everybody's seen that where you have people that have beautiful homes and they're well off. And, you know, and they constantly throw money at their kids, and yet the kids are soulless, they're miserable, they have no quality of life, they have no respect for life, because everything's being thrown at them except affection and love, and they're so starved for that that they end up getting, you know, their hearts get hardened. And then you have another mm-hmm. child that's growing up in the... really in desperate poverty, yet their humble abode is always clean and tidy. It you know, there's not much to it. And yet the struggling mother just has overflowing love and teaches the kid to think great things. You know, I there was a movie I saw recently with Will Smith in it, about a dad who really was just completely poverty-stricken. He was homeless with his little son for a long time. But he had a very good attitude about everything. He kept teaching his son to always, to believe in himself and never let anybody tell him he couldn't do something. And then years later, this guy became a multimillionaire because he finally got recognized by somebody. But what if somebody had taken that boy away from him while he was homeless? You know,
mm-hmm.
meanwhile, he was a phenomenal, and this is a true story, by the way, he was a phenomenal
is that
role
the one
model.
With Will Smith's son, his real son that was
yeah,
in it with
yeah.
him? Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. It's just every time the movie's on, I watch it. It's such a, well, first of all, the main reason I like watching that movie is because I know it's a true story. It's not just somebody's
mm-hmm.
imagining. This is something that actually happened. And I like watching inspiring stories that show the better side of us, our what I consider to be our true character as human beings. Because if somebody can rise above their sad situations and really have a triumphant life, then that means that possibility is there for anybody. But the
That's
one
right.
thing he did is he never gave up. He never allowed his son to give up. He never allowed his son to feel sorry for their circumstances. And he held a level of pride about them. I mean, he used to take them to public bathrooms to make sure that he could get washed up, you know. So, you know, I mean, that was tough, tough, tough. They were homeless for months, and yet he rallied and finally was successful. But the point I'm making is before he was successful, at any given moment, DCF could have swooped in and taken that boy away from him because he was hopeless.
Yep.
And that would have been a complete, like you said, that would have been a complete travesty.
Yeah. Well, you have to be able to look at the true emotions involved in a scenario like that. And again, that takes instinct, not just training. So we're about out of time. So I want to thank everybody. I hope. You didn't hear me read the one letter, Shell, so I'm going to keep this so you can read it this week. It was a person wrote it to a woman in Canada because she has an autistic child, and she said she should euthanize the child because he was a nuisance.
Oh, my God.
It's horrific. It's all over the internet, and it was my starting story tonight because it just blew me away. And but it kind of coincides with all the rest of this, because if there's people out there that could actually say that to a mom who's doing the best she can, you know that anything could happen. So
wow.
I hope talking about it, though, makes people realize what fools they're being, and realizes that they have to do something about that. So good night, everybody. From my heart to yours, this is Renee saying good night and God bless. Good night, Shelley. Talk to you tomorrow night.
Yes, you will. All right, good night, Renee. Good night, everyone.
Good night, babe.